Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm happy to welcome to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Anna Civic. We're going to be talking today about chemotherapy. Certainly, no one wishes that his or her pet should develop cancer, but if that ever becomes an issue, chemotherapy is an option, and it's not quite what it is in human medicine. That is to say that your animal will not experience some of the many problems associated with chemotherapy when it is used for human treatment. We're going to find out all about that when we come back after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, so happy to welcome to the program today for the first time from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Anna Civic. And we're going to be talking today about chemotherapy. Chemotherapy, of course, as a treatment for cancer in our pets. So first, let me say welcome to the program, Dr. Civic. I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
When we talk about chemotherapy, I think one of the things that really stands out to me is the way that chemotherapy has such a real scary connotation, right? And where does that come from? Does that come from the realm of human medicine?
I think a lot of it is from our personal experience with knowing a loved one who's gone through any sort of treatments on the human side. It's definitely a scary word to a lot of people.
Yeah. When we talk about chemotherapy on the human side, I mean, it's obviously a treatment for a life-threatening illness and a treatment for a life-threatening illness that consequently involves some pretty heavy doses of medication, doses of medication that can really take a visual toll on someone, right?
Yeah, it can be. People tend to have a lot of side effects from chemotherapy, and that's pretty different than pets when we're treating them. And some of that is goal related. Our goals are different. We are going for quality time over quantity. And so sometimes we do very well in terms of the amount of time we get. That being said, our goal is good quality time. And so we tend to use lower doses, don't tend to treat quite as aggressively. And as a result, most of our patients feel better than they did from their cancer, which, again, is our goal.
Okay. So let's kind of begin at the beginning. Let's talk a little bit about cancer itself. It is not just a monolithic thing. As we've talked about here on this program before, about cancer before, there is a whole host of different kinds of cancers, right, that pets can get, of course, that humans can get, but the pets can get as well. And not every cancer calls for the same treatment.
Yeah, so all cancer really is that a cell in your body started dividing and growing out of control. And that can be any type of cell. So it could be a bone cell, or it could be a kidney cell, or it could be a blood cell. And so because those are all of different types of tissues, they can behave very differently. Some of them are just a problem in that location. So it grows and grows, but it doesn't tend to spread or be able to move to other parts of the body. Other types of cancer are very good at being able to leave that location where they started and go to other places. And so that dictates what is our best treatment modality.
Okay, modality refers to the different types of treatments that are available given a certain malady. That is to say, something like cancer might be treated via surgery or radiation or chemotherapy.
Yep, those are the three big options we have, absolutely.
Now, you're primarily here to talk about chemotherapy today, but if we can, let's maybe talk about a couple different kinds of cancer and how a veterinarian like yourself might go about determining the ideal modality for addressing a cancer. So let's talk about something that may occur in a dog of a certain age. Let's talk about something like a tumor, right? How might a tumor be taken care of?
So it really, again, kind of depends where the mass is, where the tumor is. Generally, our best treatment, at least for that local disease, for where that mass is generally to remove it. That being said, sometimes we have a mass or a tumor in a place where surgery is just too risky. So brain tumors are a good example of that. If that mass or that lesion was on the outside of your body, it would be easy to remove. But because it's inside of a very important structure, we'd have to get to it, and that can be tricky. And so there are a lot of times where if a brain mass is kind of deep in the brain rather than right on the surface, we often have to use a different kind of treatment, such as radiation, to really target that spot without going through kind of the normal tissue above it or around it.
Mm-hmm. We think of surgery as being a rather invasive kind of procedure, right? Would you consider a chemotherapy invasive, or does that, just by virtue of it not involving going inside, does that make it not an invasive procedure?
We don't consider it invasive. Generally, things we consider invasive are when you have to go into some sort of body cavity. Generally, a lot of our chemotherapies are injections or pill-type medications.
When we talk about a tumor that is inside that maybe is better for a surgery, or if it's too deep inside for surgery, maybe it's better for something like radiation. Let's maybe switch gears and talk about a different kind of cancer. What about something like, I don't know, do pets get bone cancer?
They do. We see mostly in dogs, we'll see bone cancer. Generally in our bigger dogs, which can be pretty hard for people to imagine or deal with.
Mm. And so what would a bone cancer call for in terms of a modality?
We have a lot of different options in terms of treating bone cancer. Generally, again, like with most tumors, our ideal is to remove the tumor. But that can be hard because not everybody has the same feelings when it comes to things like amputation. We tend to recommend amputation, and it's our best way to deal with the tumor locally. But again, not everybody is very comfortable with that. And so sometimes we'll use other treatment options to try and do what in people they use is called limb spare techniques. And we have some that have been developed, some even at University of Florida, to try and still save the limb, preserve the limb while still dealing with the tumor. They are, it's definitely trickier to do that sometimes, though, depending on the location.
Mm. When we talk about amputation, and we're going a little bit off topic here, but it's okay. We might be talking about the amputation of a limb, say. In a dog or a cat, and just as in a person, well, let's begin with saying in a person. In a person, losing a limb is a real devastating loss. We either need our legs to walk on, or we need our arms to do every other thing that we do in our lives.
Now, we care what we look like, which is a little different.
Absolutely. And pets, of course, aren't really conscious of their looks and their appearance. Now, a pet that was, spending a lot of time, say, outdoors, or let's say you have a hunting dog or something like, well, maybe losing a limb would present more challenges in that situation. Obviously, if you have a sporting dog, and your dog's been out there and you compete throwing frisbees or something like that, well, losing a limb would probably be pretty hard on your animal. But for the most part, let's say my indoor kitty, not only does she not care what she looks like, but animals are remarkably resilient, right? And they can get around on three limbs without a tremendous amount of difficulty.
They do. They do very well. They're very adaptable. And they're also, because they have three left rather than two to start off with. I think that part of that is they just figure it out, and they really can get around a lot better because of that. So most of the times when we have a dog that we are recommending amputation on, if the owners decide to elect to go forward with that, the biggest comment that we hear afterwards is, I really thought this was, you know, he was going to do, you know, not as well as this. You told me he would do this well, but I didn't really believe you until it happened. And so they really do remarkably well. Cats will still jump high places with three legs and climb around. And to be fair, back in the olden days, that's how we used to deal with major injuries, you know, hit by a farm truck. We didn't know how to fix legs back then. And so they really do pretty well with it. But it's still, I think, there's a lot of feelings that go into deciding these things, and we have to make sure that we sit down and have these big conversations with people so that everybody's on the same page and is comfortable with whatever decision they make.
Because we are talking otherwise about a malady like cancer that can really risk the life of the animal.
Yeah, this is a lot of times, unfortunately, this is a terminal disease, and so our goals are quality time as long as we can have it, and that's a very, again, a little bit different than the shift in people. We always like it when we cure it. That would be the best thing, but that doesn't always happen, and so it's so important that we're talking about, you know, quality time and maintaining quality time, improving quality of the time. That's the whole point of doing treatments. Mm.
So we can say that, you know, in most circumstances, losing a limb to cancer in a pet is better than losing the pet.
Yes.
And we can say that we're really trying to give the animal a good quality of life in the amount of life that it has left. We haven't really hit on a type of cancer for which chemotherapy seems ideally suited. And so let's talk about some of what those are.
So unfortunately, with bone cancer, actually in dogs, it does have a high chance of spreading to other parts of the body if we just do some sort of local therapy such as amputation. And so even taking the tumor off, the little cells that have already been sent off to other parts of the body can start to grow into new masses elsewhere. And the most common place that we see it metastasize or spread to is actually the lungs. And so after something like a surgery to remove it, an amputation, or even some sort of limb spare, we recommend chemotherapy to slow down that process. The ultimate goal being to prevent the spread entirely, but a lot of times to slow it down pretty significantly. And that's where chemotherapy comes in. So
chemotherapy involves obviously medications, some drugs. And as we sort of began at the top of the show, we said that in human medicine, chemotherapy can really take a lot out of a person. You see with people who are receiving chemotherapy a good deal of kind of sickness that comes along with it, right? You're taking medications that are pretty hard on your body. I mean, the goal is to kill the cancer without killing you, but you teeter a little bit close to the edge there. We're, as you said, not talking about such heavy doses, such strong medications perhaps, or are the medications similar?
So we typically will use similar drugs, but we use them at much lower doses, and we often will spread out how often the treatments occur as well. The goal is to, you know, maximize effectiveness, of course, but we look at effectiveness a little differently because the whole point is also for them not to really know they're getting chemotherapy. So quality time is really important. So for example, in a dog with a bone tumor, typically they're getting a treatment every 3 weeks for a total of 6 treatments. It's an IV treatment. So they come into the hospital and they stay just for a couple hours to get that treatment, sometimes for half the day, you know, depending. And then they go home, and really our goal is to have no side effects. What's been shown is that we probably in veterinary medicine somewhere have a side effect risk with that in about the 15 to maybe 20% will have any side effects at all. And in people, it's much higher. It's somewhere in the 90% will have side effects. And a lot of that's really related to dose. We also don't tend to cure as many dogs as people are cured with these diseases, but we offset that with, you're a person. So we can sit you down and say, we're going to make you feel really terrible, but you might get to get married and have kids and meet your grandkids and all those things. And so you're willing to take that on. Dogs have shorter lifespans and they don't understand all those things. So really our goal is to keep them feeling good for as long as we can.
This is an important distinction to make. You pointed out that in human medicine, a person has a kind of consciousness and a desire to live as long and happy a life as he or she can. We have many things that we're looking forward to. Even into our old age, we still look forward to the future. Animals, at least our pets, we might say, probably don't have too big a concept of their own mortality, right? I mean, they're kind of living for the moment every day. And this is a great way to live if you're a pet and you have this kind of wonderful life where you wake up every morning and every day is the best day and you get to go for a walk or you get to cuddle with your human companion. And however, that comes with the kind of fear and the inability to rationalize and understand exactly what's happening to you. So you only know that, oh my gosh, I'm scared because now I'm in a car and I'm going to a place where it's cold and bright and people are like poking me and prodding me. You don't know what it's for because you don't even know as an animal that you have cancer. You know only probably that, well, I don't really feel as good as I would like to, but I don't even know that this injection or what have you is going to make me feel any better. You can say that to a human being, even a pretty young person. You can say, well, listen, you're really sick. We're going to give you this medicine. It's going to make you feel really, really bad. But in a little while, you'll feel better and then you'll be healthy, you know, as long as you live. So we've got the complex kind of paradox about not being able to really explain anything, but also not knowing what mortality is. When we talk about giving them this medication designed to expand their lives as much as we can and give them a happy life as much as we can, as you were saying, that really has to be balanced by how much suffering the treatment puts them in as you're giving it to them. How can you as a veterinarian kind of gauge the effect of a particular dose of a therapy on an animal?
So most of our patients, we try and make the vet school a very warm environment, and we do a lot of things to try and make it so that they like coming in. And we actually have a lot of patients that will come in wagging. They'll jump on the nurses. They're very excited to see them. This person feeds me cookies and snuggles me. And so we call it spa day. We try and make it a very positive experience where they don't have anything bad in their mind happening to them when they're there. We really do put a lot of conscious effort into that. In terms of the treatments, we have somewhat standard doses that have been worked out in the dog to not cause a lot of sickness, but to have benefit and improve their chance of having good days and longer amount of them. And so those are the doses we typically kind of start with, and they're based on their size and their weight. That being said, one of the things that we always check in with people is, how did it go? Were there any side effects? Was there any days where they weren't eating as well? Did they have any vomiting, any diarrhea, anything like that that made you feel like they had any time where they weren't feeling well? And we use that to kind of tweak things a little bit and tinker to get them to a dose that is perfect for them, hopefully. So this happens in people a little bit, although it tends to be, we tend to do more of the, okay, he had a day where he didn't eat, maybe we'll lower his dose a little bit if that's what we need to do, and then tell us if that changed or we need to start this medication to help with appetite, that sort of thing. In people, they tend to push you harder. Oh, you didn't have side effects. we're going to give you more drug. And that's, again, based on expectation. They want you to have a long, full life. And so they want to give you as absolute much as they can without that being the thing that limits
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Okay. So how much of the dose is dependent upon the severity of the cancer itself? Are you able to, in some kind of evaluation or exam, determine just how malignant this cancer is and guess how long before the animal would lose its life and then tailor a treatment to that level?
Yeah, absolutely. So based on what we know about how certain cancers behave in dogs and cats and what happens somewhat if we don't do any treatments, that gives us an idea of does it spread or not? Is it something that limits their life? Because if you have a tumor that doesn't spread to other parts of your body and isn't really causing you a problem, there are times where we're just going to remove it and that's it. We're not going to do anything else because it's not likely to go anywhere else. Versus we know that this is a type that's likely to metastasize. So that's where the chemotherapy is likely to help slow that from happening.
Mm-hmm. So let's kind of try and begin with an animal that comes in. And before we do that, let me just say to everyone, you're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm talking with Dr. Anna Civic, and we're discussing chemotherapy. So let's say someone has come in and has, along with a pet, and you've determined that there is a cancer of some kind that really would benefit from chemotherapy. What's the first thing that you look for in examining that pet?
Well, we always want to kind of get a general idea of their overall health. So we ask a lot of questions about appetite and energy and urination and drinking and how they're doing at home just overall. And on doing their physical exam, we look at kind of all the parts that we can feel and see externally. So we look in their eyes, we look in their mouth, we feel, their joints and their lymph nodes around their body. We feel their organs. We, as best we can from the outside, we listen to their heart and their lungs and just try and get an overall picture. You know, is this an animal that has lots of other diseases that could affect things? If their kidneys aren't working well, that can change things dramatically, or their liver isn't working well because organ function helps with how you are able to metabolize drugs and medications. And so we have to be very cognizant of these things. We often will check blood work as part of kind of a standard kind of systemic review of the patient.
Mm-hmm. So if you have an otherwise healthy animal, you can make a pretty good assessment that this animal might be reasonably tolerant of chemotherapy?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of our patients, they come in for their cancer and they're otherwise in pretty good shape. And so we can kind of figure out what the best plan is for their owner and for them and try and implement that and hopefully make them feel better and improve their quality of life.
Do you see animals of any average age, or is it a pretty broad range?
Just like people with cancer, we can see it in the young and the old and everywhere in between. Mm-hmm. We generally see dogs and cats are living longer lives because we are really good at preventative care. They get vaccines, so they get antibiotics if they get infections, and so they live through things that used to not be as well treated. And as a result, we do tend to see animals just living longer and then developing some of these things with age. But just like kids, we see youngsters too.
Mm-hmm. Are the kinds of cancer that younger animals acquire different from the kinds of cancer that older animals acquire?
Sometimes. There are definitely some similarities with people, and as a result, there's actually a lot of collaborative efforts being made to try and get better treatments for diseases that affect both young pets and young people.
when you have an animal that comes in that is older, what are your concerns in terms of thinking about a treatment, a course of treatment for an older pet?
So it's interesting because we do teach the veterinary students that age is not a disease. So just because an animal is older doesn't mean that they can't tolerate things just as well as a younger animal. A lot of it really depends what their systemic functions are. We see very, very healthy older animals, and we see ones that aren't as healthy. And that actually has a much bigger impact than the actual number of years they've been living.
Really? Okay. So if you're dealing with an older animal that is otherwise healthy, do you just proceed as you would with even a younger animal? You just treat it as though this animal is of any age but is healthy?
Yeah, they tend to respond in very similar ways unless they have some sort of systemic function problem. And so and that's true. I think we feel it's true in people too. So,
with an animal that is older but isn't really in as good a shape as it once was, does that really change the way you approach treatment?
It can definitely affect what options people are interested in. I think we still try to be very cognizant of the fact that we still can utilize a lot of the same options, but that it really depends on where what the owner's feelings are. There's a lot of things that go into play in picking out the right treatment option for the specific pet. And so we rely a lot on what the owner is telling us in terms of what do they see as the goals for their pet? What are their, their concerns? And really trying to tailor our treatments around that.
That brings us to a really good point. Let's talk about the goals that people have for treatment. And these probably vary depending on the individual. But broadly speaking, when you have a client come in with a sick pet, how do you, as a veterinarian, talk to the client, the pet owner, about what his or her goals are for treatment? How does this conversation work?
A lot of times we start off, because we're a teaching hospital and a training facility, we start off with having the student who's also learning, getting a history and trying to figure out exactly what's happening at home, what happened with the pet, what has changed, what tests have been done, what those tests have shown, so that we really, again, get a very global picture of that patient. And then we ask the owners a lot of questions about, what is the lifestyle that they lead, that their pet leads, and what their, what they want for that lifestyle to continue, so that we can really help them as they kind of let us know what they want to do. We give a lot of options, and we really want people to be able to pick the plan that works for them.
So this may be a little bit challenging to do, but tell me how you might approach some of these different options. Let's say I've come in with an animal that is a bit older. Maybe I've got a larger dog. Maybe this dog is Blake, 7 or 8 years old, a pretty big dog. And it has cancer that maybe not – it may have not spread so far, That is to say that, this animal could be, successfully treated probably. How might you present my different options?
I think usually the questions that we try and answer before we can kind of come up with a plan as how to proceed is what exactly we're dealing with. So what type of cancer is this? Because that gives us an idea of is it going to spread in the future? Has it spread yet? How does it tend to behave as a cancer? And then the next question we tend to try and answer before we can really pick an option is, has it spread yet? And figuring out truly, is it anywhere else in the body? Because that really changes what treatment options we may have, and it also changes what treatment options owners would want to go through, because it, the whole picture will change if it's all over than if it's localized.
Yeah.
And so a lot of it starts with taking a sample from the mass and to figure out exactly what type we're dealing with. And sometimes that's a little, you know, as little as sticking a needle in and getting a little needle sample. Other times, if we're not able to get a littler sample, sometimes we'll take a little biopsy. And then once, you know, from that information, then the other thing is doing tests to look for spread. Because it's easy to kind of feel the outside of the dog and say, well, you know, he seems to be doing well at home. He's eating and all of that. Unfortunately, I can't look through the dog, as I tell people. So things like x-rays and ultrasound to really look internally and say, are there any masses or anything inside that shouldn't be there that we need to investigate? And then we can kind of make a plan as to what the best option is.
Are owners of older pets usually pretty aware of the animal's natural life expectancy anyhow?
I think we get a lot of questions about that as to, you know, he's a 10-year-old dog. Is that, you know, how long do we think he's going to live? Is it worth us? A lot of questions about, is it worth, you know, spending this money doing this treatment when he's, you know, this age? And a lot of that really does come back to, it matters more how healthy you are than what your age is. So while the, you know, average lifespan of a big dog may only be 12 or 14, I have met one that was 18, and I've seen them do, you know, but they can also get very ill at 3. And so a lot of it more has to do with the health and how they're cared for. And so if they're cared for pretty well and they're overall pretty healthy, you know, it's really hard to predict anybody's lifespan.
Yeah, that must be a really hard but frequent question that you get, right? What would you do if it was your pet? Do you get that question a lot?
We do, and it's, I think, a very hard question to truly answer, because a lot of times, even if you think you would do one thing, when you're actually in the situation, you don't always do what you think you do. And so there's so many pieces that go into making these decisions that they're very personal decisions. And so we really try and get owners to make their own decision while still having us provide all of the medical information we can so that they can make an informed decision. Because we really want them to be part of the pet's healthcare and what they choose to do.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. Today, speaking with Dr. Anna Civic from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT. I'm Dana Hill speaking with Dr. Anna Civic from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We were talking about some of the questions that pet owners might ask when their animal has received a diagnosis of cancer and they're evaluating the kinds of courses of treatment that are available. And we talked a little bit about how a pet owner might say, well, to the veterinarian, well, what would you do? And it seems like, Dr. Civic, you know, that's a really challenging question to answer. And of course, it depends a lot upon the particular circumstances of that animal. I imagine that if someone came in with a 12-year-old large dog that had cancer that had spread and the dog was not in the best health otherwise to begin with, you might talk about, you know, maybe doing some care that would just make the dog feel comfortable. But, you know, the options for really extending the animal's life without causing it a lot of angst otherwise might be a bit more limited. Whereas someone who comes in with a younger animal that has a cancer that is not particularly aggressive and has not maybe spread all over, that is an otherwise healthy animal, well, the options are quite a bit different. And on a day-to-day basis, you probably see cases at both ends of the spectrum?
We do. We see a wide range of patients in very different states of disease, and it can be we have a lot of options on all ends, but really tailoring it to, what we expect to achieve with what we have available. I think that's very important information to give owners so that they can make good informed decisions about what they want and what they think is best. 'Cause really, at the end of the day, they know their pet better than we do. And so they have to be part of this process and help us to understand, what they want.
For some pets, cancer is really going to be a life-limiting illness, right? And I've spoken to some of your colleagues before in the past, particularly about cancer, and I was informed at one point that given a long enough life, many dogs will die of cancer, if it's not something else. I mean, cancer there's a pretty good chance that any given dog may end up with a kind of cancer if it gets old enough. And that is startling and kind of frightening too for anyone who has and loves a dog. But as sounds like as we've been kind of talking, it doesn't necessarily have to be a death sentence. And even if it comes to pass that the cancer is going to limit that animal's life, there are still ways to make the animal feel better and have a more comfortable existence. And it sounds like as we're talking about chemotherapy today, when you look to the available courses of treatment and you want to do something that is not especially uncomfortable for the animal to begin with, you can at a certain dose, work on kind of knocking down the cancer enough to give the animal more time. Are you able to determine with any degree of certainty how much time you can give a pet owner?
So that, again, also really depends on the type of cancer. But we are at a point with veterinary medicine where we've had some literature and some studies done that can show us exactly what happens if we, if we do this treatment. The dog tends to live on average about this long versus if we do no treatment. And so that's really helpful for a lot of people in trying to decide what they want to do. Because if we say, well, with no treatment, we expect, your pet to live somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2 or 3 months. But with treatment, we expect to get somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 months. That might be enough time and they might be very happy with that, or that might be not the enough time where they want to pursue treatment versus us having a disease where we say without treatment it's a couple months and with treatment it's a year. That may change what they want to do, and some owners may be more inclined to do treatment if we expect to get a lot more time.
And that makes a lot of sense because here we're going to get into the kind of ugly topic of money. I mean, treatment costs money. I imagine it's not the least expensive kind of veterinary problem an animal can have. So from kind of beginning to end, we're talking about an exam that will diagnose the disease, right? We may be talking about an aspirate or a biopsy. We are talking about some lab work that has to get done and processed. We're talking about kind of consultations in which the veterinarian discusses with the pet owner the type of cancer and the particular malignancy of that cancer and then what courses of treatment are available. And then even before any sort of, therapy has begun, before any kind of treatment has commenced, you're already kind of – we've already spent a bit of money just to even make the diagnosis. How expensive is chemotherapy? Is it less expensive than some of the other modalities?
So there's different costs associated with different things. Surgical cost, having a surgery done, is a bigger cost generally than a chemotherapy treatment, but you also do surgery and you're done with surgery, right? So chemotherapy, it's a per treatment type situation. And so, you know, depending if it's only four treatments or six treatments, that's very different than if we're recommending something like 12 treatments or 18 treatments or something like that. So the cost is also a little bit harder without knowing the specific disease. But chemotherapy is a lot less than it is in people, at least. But I think the hard part to swallow for a lot of owners is it doesn't seem like less is because they have insurance. So while it costs more on the human side, it is that you don't see that cost because you have a copay and that's it. Yeah. And a lot of owners don't have pet insurance. And depending on the pet insurance, they cover some things and don't cover other things. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot for people to bear in mind.
I'll here make a pitch for pet insurance. I have it for Moggy, and it is something, of course, that does cost you money up front. I mean, every month or whatever, I pay a premium. It is not prohibitively expensive for me, thank goodness. And you do, of course, have to shoulder the expense at the time, right? That is to say, when you get treatment, you do pay, but you get reimbursed for it. And the way that I've rationalized it is that I would hate to be in the position if I had a sick pet that could be successfully treated. I'd hate for money to be the reason that I had to make a kind of a life or death decision. Pet insurance, I would say, can be a pretty good investment for someone. And I'll just leave it at that. There's many ways people can investigate that on their own. So we have the cost, and some people may say, yeah, well, gosh, if you're telling me that my animal will live 2 months without treatment and 4 months with treatment, yeah, I mean, that's something where you'd have to say, that's a pretty tough. But if you're saying, yeah, a year or more, okay, I can really begin to understand that, unless you're talking about a range of, you said, an animal might need, say, four treatments, but it might need 18 treatments.
And all that depends on the type of disease and what. So with the bone tumor example we talked about, that is typically six treatments of chemotherapy. But there are other types of cancer where treatment is ongoing for a lot longer, most of those being things like leukemias. In people, this is true as well. You tend to be on treatment kind of as long as it's working a lot of times because they're such an aggressive disease.
Mm. When we talk about the treatment of cancer using chemotherapy, you mentioned sort of at the top of the show that some of the kinds of drugs that are administered are similar to the types of drugs used in human medicine. Over time, how have these medications evolved? Have they become both better at treating the disease and also less destructive to the body itself?
It's hard. Our standard chemotherapy, though, so I think understanding how chemo works will help with this, but chemo works by killing fast dividing cells. So in your body, as an adult, dog or person, you don't have a lot of fast growing cells. You're not growing generally. And so as a result, we don't see a lot of cells being affected by the chemotherapy, except for the cancer cells that are fast dividing. There are a few cells in your body, though, that still grow and divide throughout your lifetime. So the cells in the intestinal tract, which is why you can see vomiting and diarrhea, and some of the cells in the bone marrow that provide your blood cells are also, you make those every day, and so those cells continue to turn over. So those are kind of the three things that are affected, the cancer, which we want, and then some of the gut cells and some of the blood cells. And so those are the cells we have to be very careful of with our chemotherapy. Unfortunately, with our kind of more standard chemotherapies, in order to affect fast-dividing cells, and kill the cancer cells, they're going to affect some normal cells as well. And so, again, a lot of that, it's more dose, but there are now ways being looked at to reformulate drugs to try and get around some of those things. So things like putting the drug inside of some sort of substance that kind of protects it until it gets to just where the site of the tumor is. In theory, it's very good. We are still working on how to figure it out because it's not the body systems are very malleable, and there's a lot of different fancy little pathways and highways around where things can get jumbled up with that. There are some targeted therapies that have been developed in people and in dogs that are meant more to specifically target a growth pathway in a specific tumor. And those have been very successful in human medicine at targeting very specific cancers. And we only have a few in the veterinary market, but we're starting to develop those. So I think what drugs we have available is changing.
So moving forward, it may be that a greater variety of medications are available for the treatment of cancer, ones that are better at actually killing the cancer while being, less demanding on the body itself. When we talk about cancer and chemotherapy, what sort of follow-up care are we talking about? Let's say an animal has undergone a course of chemotherapy. What then?
A lot of times we are rechecking them pretty regularly. So, for example, a dog with bone tumor that we've done some sort of surgery and then given the course of the 6 chemotherapies we talked about, we'll typically recommend rechecking them about every 3 months. And usually that involves a physical exam, some dog cookies, chest x-rays are the big thing that we watch with that disease because, as I had mentioned, when it metastasizes, it likes to go to the lungs. And so that's the spot that we're always kind of keeping an eye on. But we do like to see them pretty regularly. I usually tell people at the 2-year mark, we get a little party. And if they're okay and at the 3-year mark, then they get a big cake and a big party. Because kind of like people, when you hit your 5 and 10-year marks, those are considered kind of a big deal because your likelihood of the cancer getting you in trouble goes down the farther away you get from it.
And that holds true for animals as well.
It does, yeah. So the longer you are around without developing the cancer coming back or the cancer spreading, the better shot you have long term. But really, we see those kind of changes happen once you hit the 3-year mark, you're usually in a lot better shape. So if it's something where we get there, we make a big deal out of it.
Well, in the short time that we have left, maybe we can reassure the listening audience about some things and maybe dispel some myths too. First, chemotherapy in pets doesn't have some of the same effects as it would in people. Your pet's not going to lose all its fur.
Yeah, so it's interesting because people are really worried about that. In us, our hair this goes back to that fast dividing cells. Our hair is always growing. My hair always gets longer. I need haircuts. Your dog's hair is always about an inch long, and so they don't tend to lose their hair unless they're a breed generally that needs to be groomed. So they keep their hair. I don't know that they would mind if they lost their hair. They might need a cute dog sweater for the winter. But at least it's not something we generally have to worry about.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that people believe that isn't really true about treating pets with cancer?
I think the biggest thing is that everybody's very worried about intestinal side effects and illness because that's what they see on the human side. And we just don't see very much of it because we're so careful in how we dose our medications and our goals are really quality over quantity. And so we do a pretty good job of making sure that they have, good days, not bad days.
So finally, for anyone who has some suspicion that his or her pet might have a kind of cancer, what is your first recommendation?
take them to a veterinarian and have someone evaluate them and feel them all over. And if there's any sort of lump or bump, having it sampled with a little needle to try and see if it's something we need to worry about.
Well, Dr. Anna Sivik from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Of course.